John Shook, Sam Bowman, and special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Mike Fotopoulos and Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris host the Joe and Abe Talk Radio Show. At 9, an alternative radio, Yasmin Abdel-Majid speaks on recognizing bias. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, host D-May Roberts talks with Walter Jaffe and Paul King, founders of Whitebird Dance, about the upcoming performances by Reggie Wilson and the Fist and Heel Performance Group coming to Portland. And Reggie Wilson also talks about his work. At 11:30, it's Art Focus with Andre Middleton. And at 10 p.m. tonight, tune in for a special spooky Halloween edition of the Holy Crowley Hour or Two. You might want to leave the lights on. Thanks, KBOO members, for your ongoing support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Good night, Rosalind.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Danielle.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
KBOO's John Shook spoke with Standing Rock activist Tawasi Soz a week and a half ago about what it's like at the Standing Rock encampment. Organizers at Standing Rock are continuing to call for anyone who is able to go there and support the water protectors.
I'm John Shook for KBOO. I'm speaking with Tawasi, just one name. He's a traveling activist. He's been at Sacred Stone Camp in North Dakota for about a month. He stopped by KBOO to discuss what he saw and heard there. You can find his videos on his YouTube channel, Tawasi Soz, TawasiSoce. Welcome, Tawasi.
Thank you. Thanks for having me in.
Tell me about your name, if you don't mind.
My name was given to me in a traditional naming ceremony in Southeast Arizona, Tawasi. It's from the Hopi language, and it means flower of the sun. Tawasi is my entire name, which presents some challenges.
Yeah, because everybody wants you to have a surname.
Yeah, people are in this country, in this culture, expected to have first, middle, and last names. And if you only have one name, then you end up having to bump into a lot of what I consider ethnocentric systems that require, you know, very systematic names.
Are you Native American?
On my dad's side, I'm half Native. We're from the Nooksack tribe, the Skagit, the Upper Skagit, the Swinomish, and I'll pronounce it wrong, Tsi'ichin. They're in Canada.
And you have spent the last month in North Dakota?
That's right. I was in North Dakota for almost 4 weeks.
Tell me about how you decided to go there.
Well, I've been following the story from the time it broke and the youth ran out to Washington, D.C. And I've been wanting to go, but didn't go until my daughter was ready to go. She said, "Dad, we have to go." And that's when I decided to go.
So you went with your daughter?
That's right. My daughter's Serenity is 21. And you know, the youth have a vested interest in this project because it's their children's water and their children's children's water that could be poisoned.
So tell me what you saw when you went there, when you first went there. How'd you get in? Tell me about your first day, perhaps.
Well, I got in the middle of the night, and so I pitched camp in the dark, and it was kind of hard to have a good sense of what was going on. But my first day, we spent like mostly up by the kitchen trying to help out, just whenever there was a call for volunteers to help unload or organize supplies or just to help move water because there was so much water donated. It was right after the time that the state had taken back the water and bathroom supplies from the camp. And so there was all this water coming in the form of donations for the people. And so I spent a big part of the first day just organizing water.
Where were you exactly?
I was in North Dakota on Highway 1806, just north of a town called Fort Yates, near a village called Cannonball, just north of the Cannonball River, where the Cannonball River meets the Missouri River. Just south of there is a sacred area called the Sacred Stone Camp, and that's where people go to get sacred stones that are known as the Grandfathers.
How many people were there when you were there?
When I first arrived, it was probably close to 2,000 people. That number went down a little bit because I arrived on a Sunday night. And then once Friday rolled around, I would say it went up to close to 4,000 people. And it's that way still most weekends.
You stayed there the whole time?
Well, during the time while I was there, I spent my time between the main camp, the sacred ground camp, which is where the ancestors were bulldozed and the dog attacks happened, and also the sacred stone camp. So I ended up moving to the sacred stone camp, which is the original camp, within about a week of when I first got there. So the main camp is much larger, and it was created to host all of the people. Originally, the camp started on LaDonna Allard's land, the Sacred Stone Spirit Camp, and I ended up moving over there and staying there for most of the time.
What did you do there? What did you see? What did you hear?
Well, one of the things that I did, I used my background as a cook. I do a lot of industrial, institutional cooking, so I was able to facilitate breakfast for, you know, 300 or 400 people each morning. I tended to get up around 5 and start the coffee and get breakfast moving. After that, I would do things like help with supplies or welcome people who are just arriving. I attended nonviolent direct action training. I went to direct actions. I did a fair amount of supply ferrying by like helping people get supplies to where they were needed. Some of the things I heard were the elders praying. You know, we pray over every meal. We pray constantly. So hearing elders praying and singing is one of the main things that you hear all the time in camp. And, you know, what I saw was also elders praying. You know, the police are reacting as if there's some sort of a terrorist group there. And you saw that too. There's a police command center, and you know, there are flybys of helicopters and drones and biplanes, and you're totally isolated. They have like dampening on the phones, so you can't call out or use the internet very well. There's only certain areas where you can actually get some reception sometimes.
And that is caused, you believe, by the police and the authorities?
Well, it's hard to say 100%. The rumors were that it was great for a while and then became dramatically worse. I did go and look around and found a Stingray Tower northwest of main camp. So the fact that there's a intercept tower there is beyond doubt. Whether they're also dampening the signal, it's impossible for me to know. Someone who's more into radio frequency transmission would be able to tell you, but...
And so you saw a great deal of police presence. I mean, it was easy to see.
Yeah, they're there.
Was there interactions between the campers and the police?
While I was in camp, the police never came in. But my understanding is that the police at main camp have permission to be there. So there are plainclothes officers on the ground that the tribe has welcomed as peacekeepers. But they're not... in uniform patrolling.
And you took a number of videos of your experience there. You have a YouTube channel?
That's right. I have a YouTube channel, and I mostly took videos of people who were willing to offer their time, because there's a lot of sacred ceremonies going on. You only really want to take videos of people who want to be videoed and of scenes that are okay to video. You don't want to record prayer or sacred songs. So the interviews I took are mostly of people doing supply drops.
Tell me about the mood of the campers. Is it optimistic or pessimistic?
More optimistic.
Do they believe that the pipeline will be stopped?
Well, they're stopping it every day that they're there. If they weren't there, it would have been through already.
So have you seen actions of resistance?
Yeah, we went. One of the actions I participated in was the one where we went and prayed at the Sacred Ground camp, uh-huh. where the ancestors had been dug up. And one of the main forms of resistance is prayer. So what we did is we brought prayer ties and tied them on the fence where the ancestors were buried, because prayer ties are sacred and made in prayer for the, you know, for the Creator. They're not supposed to be desecrated. The same way that graves aren't supposed to be desecrated, prayer ties are also sacred. So we tied prayer ties on the construction fence line. We didn't trespass per se, but we definitely made our presence known.
And the resistance really is nonviolence and prayer, isn't it? I mean, that's what they're afraid of, prayers.
Yeah, you can physically see old people with sacred items praying, and then young people standing between them and the police. And then the young people get arrested, and they're even arresting the elders that are in prayer. Somehow, police dogs, automatic weapons, acoustic weapons are being deployed against people who are in prayer that have physically no weapons and haven't raised a hand in anger.
So have the campers at all used violence? Do they have weapons? Did you see anything like that?
No, the only people who I saw with weapons were the police.
What would you like to bring back from this experience for those listening here?
Well, I think one of the main things to know is that the Dakota Access Pipeline is just a small portion of what's being resisted. In Iowa, the Mississippi Stand is currently blockading the drilling platform that's going underneath the Mississippi River. And it's really important to know that there are other camps popping up all over the place. There's going to be another camp, I'm sure, on the Columbia River, because the Columbia River is now under threat from coal trains. So the more pipelines and the more train lines that go up to bring these toxins into the environment, the more of these camps that you're going to see standing in defense of the water. All of these pipelines that the billionaires are setting up, they're not to benefit the people who are harmed by them. They're only to benefit a very small percentage of people. For instance, the crude oil that's being shipped through the Dakota Access Pipeline is for export. It won't even be refined in the United States. The billionaires don't want to pay the money to the refineries in this country or have to comply with the safety standards or pay a living wage to their refinery workers. So they're exporting crude oil. All that oil from that pipeline is for export. And it's the same plan with the coal, is they're planning to export the coal and burn it outside of the United States. So I would say, yeah, it's a much larger movement, and it's to do with people wanting to protect the water. I know that there are camps in Oregon to resist the Cascade Pipeline, and there are camps in Arizona and Mexico to resist the Pecos Pipeline. And there's a camp in Iowa resisting the Dakota Access Pipeline. So there are more camps going up all the time.
Was the media present?
Well, as far as the what we consider mainstream media, they were not present. The local television station shows up to film a little bit when we go on direct actions, but they don't really show up at the camp. It's the same thing with the Tribune, the Bismarck Tribune. The local media really isn't present, and the national media isn't present. But you know who I saw a lot of is international media. There are people from all around the world coming to Standing Rock, and the issue is being really well covered in international media. In other places, it's reported on daily in their national news.
So it's international media and media in a sense of people-driven media.
Yeah.
Like yourself, and of course, like Amy Goodman was there.
Yeah, you know, Pacifica and these types of groups that do more inclusive reporting, they showed up. But as far as the, you know, these groups that are owned by major media corporations, they weren't anywhere to be found.
Are you going back?
I'm going to go back in less than 2 weeks. I'm just putting together energy and supplies, and I'm heading back.
How long do you hope or plan to stay there?
For the whole winter.
And like I say, you have a YouTube channel. Are there other media sources that you use to report on what you're doing?
Well, I like a couple different websites. I like Minds.com, M-I-N-D-S. And I also use Facebook. Primarily, I use Facebook because the other activists that put live streams up use Facebook to get their information out. I would suggest finding the Red Warrior Camp. Red Warrior Camp puts up really good information. They're some of the frontline activists. And then also, if you want to find good information, look for a reporter named Johnny Dangers. Johnny Dangers is there with all of his equipment and his crew putting out information.
Were you welcomed to the camp as coming? And are others welcome to the camp to participate in assisting, in following, in protecting the water?
I was very welcome. And actually, I would say our primary need is people. Outside of legal funds to bail people out and stay at pace with the legal funds of a billionaire, we also need people. So everyone should come. If you can even come for just a weekend or even just a day or an hour, please come to camp. Bring your support, bring yourself.
I've been speaking with traveling activist Tuwasi, who has been at Sacred Stone Camp in North Dakota for the past 4 weeks and is going back again in about 2 weeks to spend the winter. You can find his video YouTube channel at